Well, we've noticed that the Sunday show where Chris Stein and Neil De Beer talk about politics is by far the most popular engagement for BizNews community members. So Rob Herseth and I are talking capitalism, business, and what's going on in the country. Last week's conversation was very well received by the BizNews community, and I'm sure today's will be even more so. I say that, Rob, I'm sure today's will be even more so because last night, the whole Dimension Data campus story couldn't hold. We thought, let's rather have a chat yesterday, which we did. And my goodness, it has been, it's gone viral already. And your views on that are discussed in another area. But it is nice to see, and I'm sure many of your critics will say that, yes, you are a capitalist activist, but not at all costs.
So true. What absolutely upsets me and disappoints me most about this Didata scandal is that there are six successful, revered, white, capitalist, corporate chieftains and business building heroes that, if you believe the judgment, if the judgment is correct, have been put the hands in the honey jar, and it is disgusting what they've done. You know, I got a lot of messages from people, particularly about Doc Watson, saying, you know, he's the most unbelievably decent, honest human being, and this is a disaster for him to be wrapped up in this. But the six of them are all named, and, you know, if the judge has done the work properly, they're guilty, guilty as sin.
Doc Watson, yeah, if he's abdicated his responsibility to his friends, I suppose that'll come out in the wash in due course. By the way, the former DG of telecoms is Andile Ngcaba, the former chairman of Didata, who took them on. And we're looking to get hold of him and to have a chat with him now and get insights from him on maybe have a revisit to all of his concerns that were poo-pooed pretty much by people in the business community. And maybe now that we've seen this, they should be taken more seriously. But anyway, we move on. Parks Tower has done something seismic. Here is the Minister of Trade and Industry challenging his own department's organization, the Competitions Commission, on a deal that many on the far left would have thought should not go through, even perhaps through their ignorance. But again, let's start at the beginning here. Tell us exactly what is at stake, Rob.
So Vodacom are buying Vumatel. Vodacom, massive company, buying Vumatel, large company. Both very well run, both successful, both delivering huge value to South Africa. And then the Monopolies Commission, which is overreached for the last 20 years, you know, filled with a lot of people that don't understand business, aren't looking at the bigger picture, aren't looking at, you know, how South Africa can move forward. And it's so much easier just to say no to these things if you don't understand them than to say yes. Parks Tower, ANC hardliner, head of trade of industry, said it must go ahead. Well done, ANC. Well done, Parks. I think it's a fantastic ruling. It's intelligent and it's good for South Africa. South Africa needs investment. And this combination of Vodacom and Vumatel gives that. You know, we need more fiber to the townships, fiber to the homeless areas. We need investment. We need development. We need growth. Even MTN, to their credit, said it's a good thing that this goes ahead. So hats off to Parks. Hats off to the ANC on this one. You know, it looks like sense has prevailed. And I think, you know, with what Trump is doing with Doge and Viraswamy and Musk, you know, needs to happen here. We need to rein in the Monopolies Commission. They have way too much say, and they're way too anti-business, anti-growth, and anti-investment. Rein them in.
Behind the scenes, it's got to be telling us something bigger. There's no way that a trade and industry minister would have stepped out of line from mainstream ANC policy, and in particular, in this case, maybe new mainstream ANC policy.
Very much so. I think what's happening is the message is clear. The GNU must succeed. If the GNU succeeds, the ANC will succeed. The ANC will survive and even thrive and even grow. And maybe we can segue onto that. But before we do, if you don't mind, I just want to jump onto another thank well done ANC topic, and that's our Minister of Electricity, Ramakoba, said in an, I read in an article, he said that he believes that small modular reactors, nuclear reactors, it's a whole new technological development lately, need to be introduced in South Africa as part of our baseload energy. So one, he's supporting nuclear, which is 100% correct. And Gwede Mantashe has been saying that for a long time. And two, he's talking about a new technology, small modular reactors. 100% agree. So well done, Ramakoba, on that as well. And well done the ANC, because again, that's intelligent. His only mistake in his commentary was to say China are the only way forward and China are leading in SMRs. Not true. Bill Gates has got an SMR business. And a friend of mine, Niklas Adalbert, who's a big investor in Africa, is a big fan of South Africa, and was the co-founder of Klarna. Niklas and his business partner, Erik Engelau Nielsen, have invested a large amount of money in a Swedish SMR business called Blykalla, B-L-Y-K-A-L-L-A. And I actually asked them yesterday, because I was fascinated by Ramakoba's comment, you know, are your SMRs ready? They will be next year. And they produce 50 megawatt SMRs at a cost of 150 million euros. So 50 megawatts, and they produce at a cost of 60 euros per megawatt hour. But here's an interesting stat that I learned lately. 1 kilogram of uranium produces the same energy as 3 million kilograms of coal. Okay? So for all the lunatic greenies and the nice environmentalists amongst us, nuclear is green and clean. So, you know, well done, Minister of Electricity, on that one. But don't just think China or Russia. There are a lot of other countries that are producing SMRs. So
we've had a number of conversations on Biz News about exactly this and the old pebble bed modular reactor, which South Africa was way ahead in the world for. There are plans there. There was a lot. I think it was 10 billion rand that was invested in it. And then because it didn't suit the political interests at the time, it was pushed off to one side. But Dr. Calvin Kim, who's a big player in our energy, premium energy, our energy group on WhatsApp for the premium members, has been pushing this aggressively. Last time he spoke about small modular nuclear reactors, he got quite a vicious response from, let's call it, mainstream greenies. But he didn't bother about that. And recently we've been seeing that the opportunity here now could be from as low as 1 megawatt reactors, tiny little things, all the way up to maybe 200 to 300 megawatts. But it's interesting that government in South Africa is now kind of getting this. It's almost like there's an upgrading in education. I don't want to say this flippantly, but we sometimes don't even know what we don't know. But it appears as though with the new government of national unity, those who have been entrusted to lead are starting to know a bit more than they perhaps cared to even look at in the past.
Maybe it's by having non-ANC members of the GNU around the table has sparked a re-interest in business, a re-interest in investment, you know, a re-interest in economic growth. And if the GNU is going to survive, and I've said this before, we need economic growth. And economic growth lifts all boats, provides employment, and we've got to tackle our out-of-control unemployment issues in South Africa. So maybe this is, you know, they're getting it at last, the ANC, or the ANC people within the GNU are getting it, but we need investment, we need growth, we need momentum, we need business to succeed in South Africa. And maybe I can hop to the GNU briefly, because there's a comment I'd like to make on this. Projecting where we are today forward to a national election, if we had a national election, let's say next year, hypothetically. If you follow France Cronier's SRF research, which we all do, all the tribes members of the BizNews do, you know, he says that the ANC is up to 45, 46% from 41%. What that really means, and this is interesting and scary at the same time, is that if an election was held next year, the ANC would not need the DA or MK in coalition. They would be able to get 55% by doing a deal with the Patriotic Alliance, Inkatha, Freedom Front Plus, and one or two other smaller parties. Because as we know, Patriotic Alliance is up to somewhere around 6% in the SRF polls. So the ANC, Patriotic Alliance, Inkatha, and a few other smaller parties, and they'd be able to run the country without the DA and without MK. Think about that, hypothetically.
But isn't that what Paul Mashatile has been floating or flying a bit of a kite on? I know he's not, you're not a fan, but he does appear to have some political substance, being the deputy president of the country.
Yeah, but he wants to bring the radicals in. You know, he's very close to EFF. He's very close to those kind of the socialist ideology, the woke ideology, the corrupt ideology. That's his camp. And you would worry about who he would want to bring into that kind of government. The DA wasn't there. I'd really worry about the people Paul wants to appoint.
How strong is the leader of the political party in South Africa? I know that Ramaphosa's got his NEC fully behind him now, but is this not the kind of party where if the leader steps out of line, and I remember Nelson Mandela shortly after he came into the presidency and being the by far at the most powerful person in the country and at the zenith of his popularity, suggesting that the vote be extended to 16-year-olds, and the ANC NEC shot him down in flames and said absolutely no way. Might that not also be something happening here? Maybe Mashatile, maybe I'm being an optimist, and maybe he's floating something out there, but doesn't have the ability to land that kind of a deal, in i.e. bringing in the crooks. But it might then give them a different option. I know we're talking much speculation here, but it's interesting to opine.
So Cyril is isolated at the moment. I mean, you can see what's going on with the Sufi and Gauteng. It's completely doing its own thing. And the ANC is fragmenting even more. But he is isolated to the nth degree. And he does rely on working with Patriotic Alliance, Gaken McKenzie, and the DA on certain matters. He needs the DA. He needs the Patriotic Alliance to support him. And he's got his stalwarts, you know, Enoch Gondwana. He's a superb man. He's really a top, top man. He's got him supporting him, the Greta Mantashe, who's a communist. I mean, I just don't get this. Greta, quit the Communist Party. You are not a communist. Stop being stupid. You know, you talk sense when it comes to nuclear power. You talk sense when it comes to coal-powered fuel stations. You've got capitalist instincts. Quit the Communist Party. And Cyril's got Fikile Mbalula and, you know, a few others, you know, and the not very smart Aaron Motsoaledi. He's got his stalwarts, but he's isolated. You know, he's got the communists, the trade unionists are not with him. It's a hard moment for Cyril. It really is to hold this all together. But, you know, embarrassingly, he's got 32 cabinet ministers, 32 cabinet ministers and 43 deputy ministers. That's 75 ministers in South Africa. Idiotic. I mean, I'd love to tell you what's happened in Argentina, if I may. When it comes to my hero, Javier Milei, the anarcho-capitalist or minarchist, you should have a look, type in minarchist into Google, tribesman, and have a look at what he really is. But have a look at quickly, can we look at Argentina versus South Africa? Argentina's had, in the 1920s, Argentina was one of the five richest countries in the world. And there was a comment like, you're as rich as an Argentine. Well, it supplied the world with beef. There was a Harrods in Buenos Aires. Do you remember? Do you know that in the 30s and the 20s?
I was aware that it was once a very rich country.
Very rich country. And then the socialists got in and they destroyed the economy over a period of 50, 60, 70 years, as socialists do. They just destroy economies. And Javier Milei came in a year ago and he came in as a libertarian. He had to patch together a coalition.
What does it mean, Rob? Rob, what does a libertarian mean?
It's for government. A libertarian believes if you take a libertarian all the way down to the absolute perfect description, it is someone that believes in the sovereign individual, that the ultimate decision maker is the individual, that you will always make a better decision for you and the people around you and ultimately your country than some elected official sitting in government. And libertarians believe in very, very small government. He, Javier Milei, went from 17 cabinet ministers. We have 32. He has went from 17 cabinet ministers down to 8 and then added one new one. And that's the job I want. It's the Minister of Deregulation. And the Minister of Deregulation in Argentina, I wrote this down. I absolutely love this. Eliminates 1 to 5 regulations every day with 3,200 structural reforms pending. Now, when Trump was running for his first term, he said, I'm not going to allow one new law or regulation to be put in place unless we get rid of 2 others. And I absolutely love that about him. That's a true libertarian. South Africa's overregulated, New Zealand's overregulated, Europe's overregulated, America's overregulated. And why? Because we have too many lawyers, regulators, administrators, and bureaucrats in government, and not enough hard-nosed business people. And I know I sent one slide to you to pop up, if you don't mind popping that one up now. It's from The Economist. I absolutely loved it. Have a look at this. This slide is 10, 12 countries, and the percentage of, I think it's the next slide. That's it. Yeah, here it is.
Yeah, not Jeremy Ord.
Okay. So look at the countries, Italy, United States, Brazil, Ghana, Tanzania, Britain, Norway. And it's the degrees of people in parliament and in government. Okay. And if you look at law, social sciences, arts and humanities and education, okay, which I think are the bad type of people, the people we don't want in government, because lawyers, the more laws, the better for the legal industry. They just continue to, it's a self-proliferating evil, the legal industry. And then administrators and bureaucrats are like light versions of lawyers. And then education, arts and humanities and social sciences, like political science degrees. These are non-degrees in my view. Sorry, journalism's in there too. I'm going to be honest. These are non-degrees, okay? These are people we don't want in government. It's light degrees. It's weak degrees. It's rubbish degrees. You want hardcore degrees, STEM, science, technology, engineering and math, including health and business. So if you look at the blue, those are the people you want in government. Those are the people that understand investing, building businesses, being efficient, they understand productivity, profitability, growth, employment. And blue is 20 to 30% at most of people in government. There are way too many lawyers and way too many BA type people and political scientists. And South Africa is no different, okay? No different. There are very few people of our ministers that are actually business people. Gayton's probably one of the only ones I can think of in our current ministry. All the rest are politicians and lawyers. Wrong people. So when we go back to Argentina, we can drop this marvelous chart. When we go back to Argentina and look at what this extraordinary man, Javier Milei, has done in 1 year, okay? Inflation was at 7,500%. 7,500%. And you're thinking, Weimar Republic, people pushing wheelbarrows filled with money to buy a loaf of bread. That's where it was heading.
Zimbabwe. Think Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe.
It's
all these clown countries. He brought within a year it down to 2.8% a month. So it's at 28% and it's going lower. In 1 year, he's had a fiscal surplus for the first time in 10 years. He's removed middlemen and social welfare. He's reduced corruption. He's in extraordinary in 1 year. And his popularity's gone through the roof. It can be done. It can be done in just about any country you want.
Just explain a fiscal surplus.
So countries run on debt or they run on tax income and growth. So you have a surplus, which means you're generating money over and above the costs related to running the government, or you are losing money, which means you have to keep borrowing or keep pumping out more currency, which creates inflation. It's simple discipline. Like in a business, if you have revenue, cost, you then either have profit or loss. It's as simple as that. And the same applies to a country. And a country has its gross national product, gross domestic product. So you have your internal economy, and then you have your economy that's affected by exports, imports, and any macro event. He's got the internal economy under control.
Just to maybe clarify that a little, South Africa runs a budget deficit of about 5% and has been doing so for, since 2008 when we had the last surplus. And the result of that is that you have to borrow to balance the books. So your debt gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And at the moment, 20% of all taxes that are paid in South Africa are used to pay interest on the debt that's built up now over the last 15 or so years. What you're saying Milei's done in Argentina, and they've got huge debts, etc., to worry about, but he's now started, he's fixed that, and now they're not running a deficit like we do in South Africa and America and pretty much most parts of the world, but he's balancing the books. We get the Argentina's getting in more tax than they're spending. And presumably that's all to do with this chainsaw policy that he was talking about, cutting the costs of government. Now, what he's done there, Trump is trying to do the same thing in America. And if you were serious about it, Rob Herzog would like to do in South Africa. Just explain how it would happen in practice.
In practice in South Africa, I'd line up all the ministries and I'd get rid of half of them overnight. Why do we need a Ministry of Women? We don't. You know, why do we need a Ministry of Sports, Arts, and Culture? We don't. A lot of these ministries are completely irrelevant. And you can push the decisions down to, you know, provinces, states, or private enterprise. Why do we need state-owned enterprises? We should sell them off, all of them. I mean, the ANC has bankrupted South African Airways anyway. And we have fantastic Fly South Air and fantastic Air Link and Sam Air serving us. We don't need the government to own South African Airways. They shouldn't have owned it. And Eskom, well, it's getting to a point quite soon where private enterprise or public-private partnerships will replace Eskom in all elements, production, distribution, transmission. In every area where we have state-owned enterprises, the private sector can do a better job and is already in some ways supplanting our SOEs. So I chopped the ministries to half in the first day. And by the end of the first year, I'd have it halved again. We'd have maybe 12 ministries in total. We would lay off 100,000 useless public workers. And you'd have to take a chainsaw to South Africa, but you could deliver the same results. We'd have a surge in foreign direct investment. We'd have a surge in trillion rand of corporates are sitting on in cash being deployed into investment, and we'd have a surge of employment, a surge within 12 months. You know, Enoch could do this. Enoch Godogwana could do this. He knows what's going on in Argentina, and I know he respects what's going on. I've been communicating with him. He could do it. But Cyril is not that man. You know, Cyril is too weak, and he's served his time, and he's got to move on anyway in 2027. He doesn't have the spine to do something like this. You need a new, tough, you need a Javier Milei. And that isn't me, but I'm happy to work with whomever that is. Maybe Elon should come back here and do that job.
He's in the wrong country.
Javier Milei, the last, isn't he? What does he really believe in? It's freedom. Freedom, freedom, freedom. It's economic freedom. It's cultural freedom. It's the freedom of all aspects. And that is what libertarians believe in. Personal freedom. Being able to decide what to do, where to do it and how to do it with respect for others. A quick point on El Salvador, if you want to talk about heroes. Bukele, I think 2-3 years ago, was elected. He describes himself as the most popular president in the world, and he probably is. And he's done many things, incredible. But he used the state of emergency to do one key thing for El Salvador. El Salvador was the murder capital, not just of the world, sorry, not just of North and South America, but of the world. He rounded up 80,000 gang members over a long weekend and put them all into purpose-built prisons. He built the biggest prison in the world, shaved their heads. Go online and have a look at El Salvador. I think they're called Mara gangs. 80,000 people rounded up and thrown in prison, okay? All with gangster tattoos. His homicide rate in El Salvador per 100,000 inhabitants in 2015 was 106. It's down to 2.4. In 2017, there were 4,000 murders that year. In 2024, there have been 80. His popularity has gone through the roof. He solved the biggest problem in El Salvador, which was the murder rate. Now, you can do the same here. Gaten McKenzie is the guy that could do that. Round up the gangsters, chuck them in jail, and off we go. And all the lefties go, oh, you know, maybe a couple of people are innocent. Well, look at the popularity of Bukele. Extraordinary. And these things can be done in South Africa. They're going to get done in America. Watch Trump. Watch Musk. It's going to happen. America's going to take off like a rocket.
You might be underestimating Cyril Ramaphosa. Having gone through his Anthony Butler's biography on him, he tends not to enter a fight when he isn't absolutely certain he's going to win. And that's why I'm cautiously optimistic here, Rob, that there are indications that Cyril, A, does have backbone, and B, just plays it differently. And when you have a look at what Parks Tower has done, that's seismic. When you talk about Sputle Ramakgopa, now welcoming small modular reactors, that's seismic as well. For a government, let us not forget that 3 years ago said only the government was allowed to produce electricity. And it's only that long ago that the private sector was brought in there. You didn't have these big solar companies or even the thought or possibility of what is now happening with the supply of electricity. So everybody has a different approach to things. Your approach is very full frontal. You go for the jugular. You say it as it is. And I think people love you for that. But there is another approach that gets things done as well. So who knows? Maybe we'll be pleasantly surprised. I'm sure you'd be the first to applaud if that were the case.
It's so obvious what needs to be done. And what I think he's doing, or his guys are doing, is good. But it's just too little, too late. It's too slow, too little. It's how embarrassing, 32 ministers in the cabinet. I mean, pathetic.
Yeah. And from where you're coming from, and you're absolutely right, we do, however, now have global role models. If you recall when Milei was appointed in Argentina, we ran a lot on BizNews about it because our instincts are definitely libertarian. And at the time, we got enormous kickback from even members of our own community who said, no, this guy's a fool, he's not going to make anything. And indeed, when he had that brilliant speech at the World Economic Forum a year ago in January, that's how recently he's been there. Most people said it wasn't going to work. So now that the evidence is coming through, perhaps then politicians elsewhere in the world are waking up and saying, whoa, we need to do something about the pendulum having swung much too far to the one side.
So the first face-to-face meeting Trump had is with Milei. Says it all. So I think you're right. I mean, I think countries are going to look and go, well, it can be done. And in some cases, it'll have to be an inspired leader saying, just grabbing a country by the neck and saying, I'm taking it in this direction. In other cases, the population is going to demand it. But what happens in South Africa?
Well, what if Cyril finds
you? Just wasting years with this sort of fat, unproductive, useless mob running us. You know, it's so clear how we can grow at 6% a year. Wouldn't that be lovely? People being employed, the economy booming. It's so easy to do. You could turn this country around in 6 months. But has Cyril got the absolute spine to do it? No. And I think what he's doing is good stuff on the edges, and that's it.
All right. I'm going to revisit that and ask you, you know, to put your neck on the line now. If Cyril Ramaphosa were to phone you and say, okay, Rob, I see your criticisms. We do approach things differently, but we do need an Elon Musk in government. We need a Malay in government. We need to fix this up. I would love you to work with me. What would your conditions be?
He's got someone in his cabinet that can do it better than me, and that's Gayton McKenzie. Just put Gayton in as Minister of Deregulation, Productivity, and Efficiency, and anti-gangs. He can do what Bukele and Malay has done, but he's got to be given the mandate, and he can't have any muffin heads looking over his shoulder or signing off on things in triplicate. He's got to be given a clear and unequivocal mandate to get it done and move fast. Because the key with this is you really have to move fast. It's not something, you know, death by a thousand cuts, because there's pain in the process. So the faster and harder you do it, the better. As with anything, if you know someone is not working out for you in a company, fire them. Walk through the door and fire them. Don't pussyfoot around. And the same applies in even more important manner to government. Fixing things, you got to be fast and furious and make it happen. Listen, I'd take the job. I'd absolutely take the job. But he's got people around him that can do it, and Gayton's the best of all. Gayton actually was in touch with Malay, was in touch with Bukele, went to Singapore to look at the impact of the death penalty. He's already got that in the back of his mind.
I'm just thinking from an ANC point of view, just speculating here, it would also suit broader politics to have a stronger patriotic alliance. If Gayton were to be given that job and to succeed in it, which is a big if, there's no question that he would eat very deeply into the DA's voter base, which he's already been doing. And maybe that's a political reason for the ANC, in particular Cyril, given his legacy, that he'd surely want the ANC to get back above 50% at the next election. Perhaps from a political perspective, it's worth a chance. And if he doesn't succeed, well, yeah, you know, he was PA. Us ANC guys could do it better, kind of thing. Interesting point you're raising there.
Yeah. Look, I think there are people within the DA that could do it. You know, Helen could do it. Jan Schreiber could do it. They're both tough, focused, and, you know, given a complete mandate and autonomy, they'd get it done and they know what to do. But the current structure of the DA is, you know, the committees. You know, you have very good people, but they report into committees. Whereas Gayton doesn't have committees around him in the PA. He doesn't have any bench. It's really him. He's perfect for it, Al.
Why are you such a big Gayton McKenzie supporter? And I'll just remind people at one of the BizNews conferences, you shocked everyone in the room by saying, this is my cabinet. And you went through the numbers, and there were some very interesting members there, most of whom, well, people could nod their heads or say, oh, I'm not really that keen. And then you got to the president and you said, Gayton McKenzie, and there was a hush in the room, as if to say, Rob Herzog, have you lost your mind?
I said, there are many people that could fill these cabinet positions, and there are many very good people in South Africa that could be president, but why not Gayton McKenzie? And I remember you when you kind of went, Rob, lost your mind. I met Gayton 3.5 years ago. A buddy of mine, Gavin Verigi, said, listen, Rob, you've got to meet this guy. He's unbelievable. And then I had put it in the book. And then just 2 months later, when the meeting, and I was on my way to the meeting, called by a wonderful assistant, Annette, and said, who's Gayton McKenzie? Why am I meeting him? She said, I don't know. You told me to put him in the book. Okay, well, too late to cancel. This half an hour meeting went for 3 hours. And I walked away from it saying, I've met one of the most extraordinary human beings walking this planet. He is a libertarian. Like Javier Milei, he is principled. He's got values. He's got the highest standards. He's, you know, a Judeo-Christian. He's a capitalist. He studies poetry. He's done a lot of reading. He had a lot of time in prison. He did a lot of reading. And he's come out as a patriot, as a believer in South Africa, and as an honest, decent man who's found redemption. But he's really one of us. He wants to fix South Africa. He knows how to do it. He stands on his principles and his values. He is an extraordinary human being. And, you know, a lot of people doubt him. They go, oh, he's a gangster. Oh, he's too big and scary and a populist. And he talks in this kind of domineering manner. All right, you know, but he is the real thing. And if you meet him, like so many people have done over the course of the last 3.5 years, they come away and they go, this guy is extraordinary. And I'll name some of the tribesmen: Andrew Jarvie, Warren Wiecki, Adrian Gardner, Nick French, yourself, you know, your whole business team. You've seen in him an extraordinariness. And I'm a believer. At least he's not the only one. A lot of people can do a good job in this country, but Gayton is extraordinary. I mean, I wish I owned the book and movie rights to his life, because when they're produced, it's going to be one of the greatest documentaries ever. Yeah. It's going to be an Before Arnold Schwarzenegger type art. Yeah.
Before you met him, did you read his book? Did you know his story?
No, I drove to the meeting not knowing who the hell he was. This other than Gavin Regis, who one of my best friends, said, you've got to meet him. And that was good enough. I had no idea what to expect. And this big thing with a gap between his teeth and this big green tracksuit, sort of overweight, turns up with a grin, puts his hand out. I'm like, what am I doing? And that was it. Extraordinary man.
Well, it's a heck of a story, and I think you're right. The movie rights one day are going to be worth an absolute fortune. But moving on, Rob, to it's interesting the points that you made there. Your own beliefs. Last week, I asked you about your values and what they were, and I guess it was a little unfair because I didn't give you the chance to think about that. I've no doubt you have thought about it because it. You didn't answer it. Have you got a answer for me now on that?
Yeah, it's a sort of scramble of beliefs and values and principles. And I guess the most important of all is a saying that I love. It says, what's the point of life if you don't try and do something remarkable? Now, everyone's got an excuse not to do things. Everyone's got an excuse to not prioritize what's important, or just take risks and get things done, or just say what you really believe. So courage is what probably number one. And, you know, I was a cowardly lion for many, many years of my life, and then fell into this hellhole of public speaking and political activism and capitalist activism. And there's no turning back. Yeah. Once you've said what you've said, you keep going forward. I'm a minimalist, and I don't know if that's a principle or a value, but I don't believe in possessions. Maybe because I've been able to have them, I don't want them. I don't wear watches. I only really wear blue and white when I dress. I don't collect anything. In fact, the only books that I own are, where are they? Somewhere up here. Okay, I can't find them. I only own about 20 books. I gave the rest away. I don't have vases. My wife just said, if you ever give me jewelry and diamonds, and I'm going to sell them on eBay. And I said, wow, that's interesting. Why? She said, why should De Beers tell me that shiny stone is worth anything? Why should Hallmark cards tell me tomorrow's Mother's Day? It's marketing. It's made up. It's nonsense. And so I'm a minimalist. I don't collect anything. I don't own possessions. I like big houses, money in the bank, and great experiences. That's it. Memories for the rocking chair. I believe in freedom. I believe in economic, political, cultural, and personal freedom, like Javier Milei. I believe in self-reliance. I think you've got to rely on yourself and believe in yourself, regardless of the cost. And as you know, yesterday, when we spoke about Didata, I was talking about 6 people that have been friends of mine, that I like, that I've admired. And I think if the ruling is correct, they've done a terrible thing. A terrible thing. They probably won't talk to me again, but I have to tell the truth. I can't just attack the ANC and then defend the 6 guys in Didata who've done potentially something that's criminal. I've got to tell the truth. I believe in continual study, reading, learning, and listening. I've got books all over here that I'm reading, and then I give them away. I dog ear them, mark them up, and give them away. I don't keep them. And I believe in compassion. And there's a lovely movie, and it wasn't a very good movie with Kevin Spacey, but it was a movie called Pay It Forward. And I really made that part of my life. If you do me a favor, Alec, I'll thank you, but I'm not going to pay you back. My job is to pay it forward to someone else. And I do every day a random act of kindness. Just to, you know, I'll be in an engine, I'll pay my bill, and I'll see behind me two or three people with milk and a loaf of bread. Whereas I've got all my wonderful stuff in front of me. And I say, I'm paying for these four people. I don't want them to know who I am. I don't care. Pay it, move on. You know, I'm driving through Bishop's Court, you know, steep. I can see it's about to rain. There's a lovely lady with her kid all wrapped up with heavy stuff. Stop, pick her up. Where are you going? Even if it's 20 minutes out of my way, I'll call my wife and say, I'm doing a rack. I'm going to be late. And I'll drive the lady and her kid all the way to Weinberg or wherever. And every day I do one. Not because I want people to know who I am or for any other reason than it's my duty to pay things forward. And that's I'm a Stoic. I don't believe in religion. I think religion is actually a form of tyranny and some are more tyrannical than others. We can debate that later. But I'm a Stoic. I try and practice Stoicism. And I'm not perfect. I mean, like everyone else, do stupid things and say stupid things, lots of them. But that's the life I try to practice. Actually, I'm looking at this book right now. I want you to see it. Probably back to front. The Daily Dad. 366 meditations on fatherhood, love, and raising great kids. And every day I opens the page and reads. Lovely. But I mean, then, you know, can I put it into practice? Not necessarily. There we go. That's the best I can do. I try my best.
It's quite a list, Rob. And I guess we could unpack many of those. But the one part I'd like you to just explain a little more, because I'm not sure everybody watching this or listening to this would know what you mean by it. But a Stoic, what is a Stoic?
So 2,500 years ago, the philosopher in ancient Greece called Zeno developed this way of living your life. And the basis of it is the obstacle is the way. So the obstacle in front of you is actually the whole point of life, to tackle it, go through it, go over it. You know, life is not a panacea, but the obstacle is the way. And then Stoicism died off. And then Epictetus, who was a slave, a crippled slave, picked it up. And it developed as a very interesting and important way to live your life in ancient Greece. And then it died off again. And then one of the greatest human beings that ever lived, Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor, the greatest Roman emperor, took it up, and he lived his life as a Stoic. And he's the most interesting proponent of Stoicism that I've ever read about, because he was the most powerful person on the planet. He was the richest person on Earth. He was the most powerful person on Earth. And the Roman Empire was at its peak. And yet, he woke up early every day. He did his jobs. He was kind. He was decent. He lived his life as an extraordinary, decent, compassionate, kind human being. And to me, it's, you know, I've had a huge number of benefits in life that other people have. And so I'm trying to make it my duty to live life with courage, with meaning, with compassion, and all the values I give. And that's the basis of Stoicism. So it's a philosophy. It's one of many. And I'm reading Nietzsche, I'm reading Sartre, I'm reading others now. Funnily enough, I used to think philosophy was for BA students, and I like dismissed it. And then someone explained it to me. Maybe if you give me 30 seconds on this. When 5,000 years ago, a volcano would erupt and we couldn't explain it. We didn't have the science and technology and math and engineering skills. We'd go, it's the gods. The gods, or people would die in childbirth. It's the gods. We now know why people die in childbirth. We now know why volcanoes erupt. We actually, once we work things out, they drop into the sciences. They become, go into math, they go into engineering, they go into chemical engineering, they go into science. So philosophy is the leading edge of human intellect. The philosophical issues being debated by philosophers are the issues that haven't been proved by fact or science yet. And once they do, they go into one of the sciences. So I find philosophy fascinating. And if I have a higher power, my higher power is standing on the shoulders of the giants that have come before us, the philosophers. It's not this mythical thing called God or these tyrannical structures called religion, my view. It's philosophers, and I'm really getting into that now. Sorry about that. Weave, Donald Trump weave. But that's where I am, really enjoying it.
Stoicism is it's a journey, it's an exploration, it's something that you discover through the nudges of others. You would be aware that Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett are big supporters of Marcus Aurelius. In fact, Rob Wynn, I like having a little bust in my office, just to look at, just to remind me of someone great who lived in the past, whose example can be followed and just be remembered, because we are human and we do lose concentration and focus very quickly. And I couldn't find a bust of Marcus Aurelius until I went to Rome and there searched all over the place. And there it was, Marco Aurelio. And he's sitting there. I can have a look at him and remember what it was that he wrote in Meditations. And I think that's the most interesting part of it, was that he wrote a book to himself. It was notes to himself, not for publication. And that was picked up and it's been published and is now a great work of philosophy. So it's interesting, just with your conversation now and your insights, we don't know how many people will be pushed on a different, or be nudged towards a different role, a different path. Something before we go today that I'm really interested in, Alex, is
before you do,
I
just noticed this on my study. See this? Memento mori.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
This is all the weeks you have in life. Okay? And I'm down here on 64. So I've used up all this, you know, and it gets you up to in your 80s. So I've only got this left. I've only got this bit left. And it says, it is not that we have a short time to live, but that we waste much of it. Life is long enough, and it has been given in sufficiently generous measure to allow the accomplishment of the very greatest things, if the whole of it is well invested. Seneca. This is Stoicism. So I didn't have that here as a prop. Keep it here. Okay. Brilliant. Sorry, you had a question.
Brilliant. Yeah, my former neighbor, Nick Benadel from Gibbs, who started Gibbs, he has a, I don't know if he still has it, but he certainly used to have a glass bottle on his desk, and he put marbles in there, and the marbles did something like your example there, and the marbles, every month he would take a marble out, and that was because there's a defined kind of actuarial period of your life. There we go.
There's another one, 4,000 weeks. Hans Hosling gave it to me. Almost done.
But if you get that this could be the last day of your life, as Marcus Aurelius says, then you do tend to live life a little differently. Where did it come for you? When did the change? Because you said earlier, and I wanted to pick up on that before I go to the last point, but you said earlier that you were a cowardly lion. I guess you're making a reference then to The Wizard of Oz. Just help us through that. How were you a cowardly lion, and then what happened to change it?
You know, it's like anyone else. You know, firstly, I went to boarding school, got bullied because I was the wealthiest kid there. I was a mummy boy. And at age 16, I started to grow physically, and that helped. And it got to a point where I had to either stay in the shadows or become the cheerleader and tell all the jokes and take the hits. And I went this way, you know. And then at UCT, I was, you know, the noise and soul of every meeting and every party, loved or not loved, it didn't matter. And from then on in my life, it was one direction. But, you know, inside of me, I'm probably still that 14-year-old, unhappy boarding school kid, missing my parents and being bullied. You know, the layers of the onions outside protecting me. And, but I do listen to Jordan Peterson a lot, and he speaks very well to young males, you know, and he says, a good man is not a kind and gentle man. A good man is a dangerous man who keeps that bit under control. And I do think that is correct. You know, you've got to stand up against bullies. You've got to call out the bad guys. You've got to try and live your life properly. And you've got to have courage, 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 which is my number one value that you asked for. Yeah. So I'm not fearless, but I'm not fearful either. And I love the expression, the only thing I fear is fear itself. That's like, mm-hmm. I love that. But where did it come from? It also came from my wife. You know, marrying Katie changed my life forever. You know, she makes my life. She's extraordinary. She supports me, but not all the way. She tries to direct me. I've learned to say no to her, but she turned me into a minimalist. She's extraordinary. She's from another planet.
New Zealand.
No, I don't mean New Zealand. I think Saul Fitzpatrick said, you bloody staffer, you stole the only beautiful one we ever produce. And he's right.
that's an interesting, and thank you, a very generous sharing of your own personal thoughts and personal ideas. But courage comes in many different forms. And I guess for some people, the definition of courage would be, you don't mind getting a punch. You don't mind taking a punch for saying things. What's your definition?
Being true to yourself. You know, like last night, telling the truth about the Didate executives and not backing down because they're friends of mine. They've invited me to golf tournaments. They have been friendly and kind and generous. And I'm saying if the judgment is correct, what they've done is illegal, immoral, and a terrible thing. You know, I named the names. And I took a while to name their names because I just felt bad. And that's what it is. It's just, regardless of the cost, telling the truth and standing by what you believe. Gate McKenzie stands with Israel. He didn't have a single Jewish backer or investor for Patriotic Alliance, but he knew the right thing was, I stand with Israel. And whatever the cost, he's done that. That's courage. And that's absolutely something I admire, not just in him and other people that do that. It's not taking the easy route. It's not letting someone stand up and be the head up above the parapet. It's getting up with them or being the first one up. And there are many ways to do it. Someone last night said to me, I was at a Herschel event, they said, and you are fearless, Rob. You are fearless. And I said, well, I have some advantages. I can't be deplatformed. I can't be fired. So my job is to do and say what other people can't afford to do and say. And that's why I criticize corporate South Africa, because they can afford to stand up and they don't. Well, they haven't in the past. They haven't up to the election, silence of the lambs. And I really am horrified by it, being disgusted by it.
If your money does help though.
It does, no question. But then it's a responsibility. You've got the if your money, you need to stand up and be counted.
Let's close off with a controversial topic of Ozempic, weight loss drugs. Not big in South Africa yet, but boy, are they taking the world by storm. And
I know why you asked, Yuri, because we played golf a week ago and I told you I'm on Ozempic. You pushed me under the bus here. Okay, let's talk about Ozempic. It is taking the world by storm. The Economist, about 3 weeks ago, did a front page and a huge supplement on the wonder drug. And they said Ozempic is as great a breakthrough in medical pharmaceutical drug technology as the pill and as antibiotics. Those three will change the world. I'm on Ozempic, okay? Ozempic was invented or created as an offshoot of treatment for type 2 diabetics. And as part of the insulin treatment, it was discovered that they lost weight, there was anti-obesity, but all the other markers improved. Okay? Blood pressure down, risk of heart attack down, liver and kidney improved. There are all these incredible benefits to Ozempic, incredible, in addition to the anti-obesity. So they're positive effects independent of weight loss. So I was 102 kilos at my tubbiest. For 2.5 years, with boring exercise and boring diet, I got down to 96 kilos. Okay, I'm 6'2". Ozempic, 6 weeks later, 84 kilograms. I lost 12 kilograms in that period of time. Okay. And it's absolutely extraordinary, the other benefits to this treatment, okay? Unbelievable. There are anti-aging benefits. There are benefits with people who have rheumatoid arthritis. I've got to look at my notes here. I actually jotted something down. Reduction in heart attack and cardiovascular problems. Irritable bowel syndrome reduction problems. Autoimmune problems are a huge benefit to those. Inflammation, anti-snoring, anti-sleep sleep apnea. And in addition, they're going to come out with very soon that there are anti-addictive qualities too. I was never a big drinker, but I just don't really feel like picking up alcohol and drinking it. And how it works is as simple as it slows down your digestion. You and I order pizzas, okay? Or I used to. I'd eat the whole pizza. Now I eat two pieces, maybe a third, and I'm full. And that's it. Move on. You eat better. You feel better. It's a wonder drug. I think 18% of Americans are now on it. But you know what I hadn't thought about is I read an article saying that the sale of diet books has collapsed because people don't need them anymore. But what else? We should be shorting Burger King, McDonald's, Cadbury, Roundtree, all the fatty food companies. You start shorting them because the world's going to be on Ozempic soon. Novo Nordisk initiated it. Now the value of Novo Nordisk is bigger than the whole of Denmark, which is where it's based. Eli Lilly is coming in strong. And within 12 months, they're going to have a pill version instead of this little pen once a week version. Everyone will be on Ozempic at some point. Everyone.
Sure.
It's a wonder drug.
RFK, Donald Trump's guy, and I didn't throw you under the bus, Rob. I did warn you that I wanted to ask you about this one. But RFK is against it, which he says that you should be able to do this naturally rather than having to rely on a drug.
Yeah, but the same applies to religion. You should be able to deal with the world without having to believe in, you know, the Bible and going to church and all that. Same thing. It's legal. It's prescribed. It's approved. RFK can say that. Fair enough. It's like Tim Noakes is still banging on about banting. Well, fair enough, but he's got to move with the times. He's, you know, people are not going to be. I've got a buddy, Dylan McKenzie, who you know very well. Dylan was 125 kilos. He's shorter than me. Tubby. He started on Ozempic for a month, got this sort of trajectory going, and then went into the carnivore diet. And he's in unbelievable shape. He's a cricketer, golfer, hits the ball even further than he did before and straighter. So everyone will be on Ozempic. Watch.
Rob Herzhoff, always enlightening, always insightful, and always courageous. Thank you for being with us today and for sharing your insights with the BizNews tribe. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.